Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of The Awesome with Cody. I'm your host, Cody. This week's episode, we're going to continue along with the August theme of awesome bands that broaden my horizons. I keep changing the name of it. This week, which I think I mentioned last week, we are going to talk about the band Jawbreaker. Jawbreaker, not to be confused with the Alicia Silverstone movie, has nothing to do with that. But the name comes from the same thing as Jawbreaker, the candy, also referred to as the band was very instrumental for a lot of, groups early on in the, music in the music realm, at least the punk rock, realm. They consisted of, three gentlemen. The lead vocals and guitar were done by Blake Schwarzenbach. You had Chris Bauermeister on bass and backing vocals, and Adam, I think it's Paffler, I'm not too sure, on drums. But as they met in New York when the they were all going to NYU and formed a band early on in the wee years of 1986, and then... didn't play their first actual show until like 89. And then shortly after that released their very first album, which was an album called Unfun. Before I get into those ones, a little bit about the only real member that went on and did a whole lot of stuff, which is Blake. Blake's vocals are very unique in the way that they're very gritty and actually caused him to have throat surgery later in life. He's been cited as being a favorite vocalist of many people. One of them, including, Ben Nichols of Lucero, who I'm sure I'll talk about at some point, in this, but his vocals are very distinct. Even after his throat surgery, they were still pretty unique. And I'll talk a little bit about his side project stuff in a little bit, because there's one I want to bring up. So that's where Blake kind of went, or his kind of thing. He had a very successful career with for 10 years as the lead vocalist and guitarist for Jawbreaker, and went on a couple other things. The band released their first album, Unfun. It was released in 1990. The big songs from this song, or from this album, there's several really big releases from this particular one. One of the best ones is Fine Day, See-Through Skin, Imaginary War. What other ones are on there? Down is a good one. Gutless, a couple other really good songs on there. This album, for me, Busy was on there too. That's a really good song as well. It was a really good entry. This is not the actual, I shouldn't say entry for me, entry into the if you really want to start fresh, you can listen to Unfun. My first introduction to them was with their next album, which is Bivouac. If you go to iTunes and Spotify, you'll find the remasters of their first three albums that were released later, much later on. So they do sound a little bit different because they're remastered. They're a little cleaner than what originally were released back in the way day. But with Bivouac, the track list actually changed quite a bit. If you ever listen to the LP, the vinyl version of it, the original pressing of it versus the CD version of it, it plays a wee bit differently. Chesterfield King, which is the big song off this album, was moved up to song number three, but I think the the overall flow of the CD tracks actually were better than the LP tracks, and I don't know if that was a planned maneuver or not, they were, you actually got a couple extra songs thrown in on the CD version, which were only released on the 12-inch EP for Chesterfield King. So way back in the day, if you bought the LP, you didn't get the those extra songs. But if you bought the CD version, you got tour song Face Down, You Don't Know, and Pack It Up added to your CD playlist, along as well as the switching of Chesterfield King to track number 3, ahead of actually right after one of their best songs on there, which is Big. If you've asked me, that's one of their best songs. The other couple big ones on there were the self-titled Bivouac, Face Down. I want to say it's Pack It. Pack It Up was a pretty big song. Chesterfield King was the big song from that one, which many bands have covered in the past, more so than most people would like to actually admit. But there's quite a bit on there. And then came 24 Revenge Therapy, or 24 Hour Revenge Therapy, which was arguably probably their breakout album, which actually was then the reason they got signed to a major label at the time, and I'll go over that in a little bit, because that had some animosity and hostility from band members as well as fans, but we'll go into that in a little bit. But 24 Hour Revenge Therapy was the follow-up to Bivouac, and by far one of the most solid albums you could possibly imagine. Oddly enough, this doesn't actually include their biggest hit most people know them by, which is Chesterfield King. You would have this particular one, their main standout song was Boxcar, probably one of the better well-known songs. You also you had on this one, you had Ashtray Mountain or Ashtray Monument. You had Do You Still Hate Me, which was a really big one. You had is it on here? I have my notes here. I'm looking on here as well. And then I think that's really it for big songs on there. One of my favorites is Condition Oakland and Ache, which are all in the middle of the album there. Outpatient's a really good song too. Actually, it's a really good solid album. Matter of fact, to note of this particular album, Rock Sound, which is a big music really publication, I guess it really is their website. Back then it was a magazine, listed at number 34 on their 51 most essential pop punk albums of all time. And then BuzzFeed put it at number 18 of the 36 best 36 pop punk albums you need to hear before you fucking die, which is, I mean, pretty cool to think about. This particular album really brought them to the forefront of the record industry, because this was actually produced by Steve Albini, who worked on several different produced several different albums that you may have heard of from bands, well-known bands, from everybody from Nirvana to newer bands like, well, I don't say newer, but later on bands like Bush and Chevelle. He worked with the Pixies. He worked with the Breeders, which is obviously very closely connected to the Pixies. He worked with several different ones. He actually is the lead vocalist and guitarist for one of my personal favorite bands, named Shellac. They're a very, very large and I want to say art pop bands, but they're very very independent, very bizarre, and that's I'll go into that craziness with Shellac another time, because Shellac is a whole different ball game when it comes to music and what they did. But pretty amazing anyways. But Steve Albini is a huge producer. He's worked on, like I said, several different huge bands and huge albums that have come out. But you know, that's more of that later at another time. And then so right after that, their next big release, which happened a year later. Which was their major label breakthrough or album that was looked at when they signed to a major label. A lot of fans were very worried that they would change the sound quite a bit, and really they didn't. The big thing you'll notice if you listen to all of them is "Dear You," their 1996 or 1995 release. Had a lot more money behind it and a lot more time to produce the songs. One of the big things, though, which led to the split in the band right after this album and the tour that followed it, were the fact that Blake and the producer at the time were doing things outside of the other band members. They focus a lot on Blake's vocals as well as his guitar, which they spent a lot of time mixing the album to hear those a lot more. And so some people didn't really like that so much, mainly the band members, the other band members. It was quoted at one point that I think it was during the documentary filming, the documentary is actually not even out yet, that Chris Bauermeister actually stated that he and Adam, the drummer, recorded all their parts and then basically dipped out, and it was just for a few months, it was just Blake and the producer working on the album, finishing up, polishing, anything like that, and then they toured, and then after that summer of 96, I believe, is when the band split because of the tension between the bands themselves. Rob Calvino, who is the producer on Dear You, who's done a lot of different bands, but mainly mainstream bands, he produced a lot of the early and later on Green Day albums, everything from Dookie to Bullet and a Bible. He did Insomniac, Nimrod, American Idiot. He worked with Goo Goo Dolls on their two big albums. He worked on The Black Parade with My Chemical Romance. He worked with Dave Matthews Band, Phil Collins, Kid Rock, Shinedown, Paramore. I think he did something with them. So a lot of different bands that he worked with, it's a really good album. The songs on there, so Accident Prone, Fireman, Chemistry, Jet Black, Bad Scene, Everyone's Fault, all amazing songs. There was the re-release version of it, includes a remastered version of Boxcar, I believe, on there as well. But I could be wrong about that. I can't remember if it's on there or I think it's on it might be on the remaster or remastered version back in 2004, 2002 or something like that. That they basically did it. And then they had, they released a live album, that was recorded in the lead up to the breakup of in 1996. That was recorded. I can't remember where. Actually, it probably tells me on here if I look at it. which it does. I don't think I have it pulled up here. Well, let's pull it up. But they recorded this, I want to say it was like 2 months before they broke up. I want to say that's what it was. I actually heard about these guys. I heard them for the first time actually in concert. I saw them in 1993. Yes, 1993, I believe. I was at the tender age of 12 at the time. I saw them with they opened for Nirvana. I want to say it was 1993. It might have been 92. No, it was 93. Yeah, it was 93. They got together because Steve Albini produced In Utero in 1993, and then obviously later on worked with Jawbreaker on their 1994 album 24-Hour Revenge Therapy. But that's how they kind of cut. I do believe that's how they got the attention of Steve Albini, was on that tour with Nirvana in 1993 in support of In Utero. So I saw them and I was like, yo, I dig them a lot. I am going to listen to their stuff. And that's when I found the album Bivouac, because the 24-Hour Revenge Therapy wasn't out yet. And then I bought Unfun and listened to that. And then later on, the next year, I bought 24-Hour Revenge Therapy. And then later on, a year later, their big major label release of Dear You. But anyways, that's how I first heard of them. But the live album that was released in 99 was recorded the April 30th of, well, the album's called Live 4/30/96, which is April 30th, 1996, when they were actually, the majority of the tracks were I'm reading off the description of it. Most of the tracks were recorded at Warfield Theater in San Francisco, California, where the band appeared in support of the Foo Fighters and Ween as part of the Rock for Choice benefit in 1996. Was released in on the label Black Ball Records, which is the main one that they released under. Well, not the main one. They released 24-Hour Revenge Therapy on that, I believe. Nope, I don't think that's right. I should look it up, but I didn't. They did that, and then shortly after that, a couple years later, they released a collection of B-sides and outtakes recorded from all their albums. It's called Etc. Clever name, I realize. I know. I don't know why I took credit for that. It wasn't me that thought of it. But so they released that, which had quite a few good songs on it as well. That one, we had Kiss the Bottle, which is the big one off of that album. They had another really good song is Peel It the Fuck Down. I need to pull up this here. Yeah, Gutless. Peel It the Fuck Down. Cover of an REM song. The Pretty Persuasion. A Psychedelic Furs cover of Into You Like a Train. Which is such a dirty sounding song. Shield Your Eyes was a really big song on that. Caroline, the oh, With or Without You, U2, which is on this album, is using the melody from three different songs, U2, The Misfits, and The Vapors. And then he sings over the top of it. It's pretty, pretty cool song. And you know me, if you listen to the first episode of this month, is about The Misfits. And I didn't talk about that particular song, that was done, but I mentioned how a lot of people have used Misfits songs to cover them, but the Jawbreaker is one of them. Jawbreaker, I've seen a few times, a handful of times, not as many as I've seen The Aquabats or Soul Distortion by any means. But more times than I saw The Misfits, the true Misfits, not the partial versions of them. I don't really have a personal story, to go along too much with Jawbreaker. It's more to go along with Blake and Jets of Brazil. Jets of Brazil was the band that, Blake, put together with, a former member of, the former drummer from Texas Is the Reason, Chris Daly, as well as a sort of on off and on guitarist for the band, Helmet, and the bassist for Helmet, and also he played bass in a hardcore band called Ignite way back in the day in 1990. Jets of Brazil formed in 1997. A year after the breakup of Jawbreaker, after Blake moved back to New York, and he met up with, well, he knew a couple people, but he met up with Jeremy, who was the gentleman I was talking about from Helmet and Ignite, and they started recording on a 4-track player using a drum machine until they got the former drummer from Texas Is the Reason, Chris Daly, and they released 3 albums on Jade Tree, drastically different than what people wanted them to be, because everyone associates Blake with Jawbreaker, and this never lived up to it. I actually dig these albums a lot, especially Orange Rhyming Dictionary. Four Cornered Night's really good, and of course Perfecting Loneliness is a really good album too, but Orange Rhyming Dictionary was their 1998 release, and it was a really poignant album. Blake has always been known to pour a lot of his self into the songs. He has been quoted several times as saying that most of Jawbreaker's songs and even some of the Jets of Brazil songs were they were basically taken right out of his journal. So if you listen to a lot of the Jawbreaker songs, there's very few repeating choruses that happen because of the fact that if you write a journal, you don't really write choruses in there. So then they added those on, but a lot of them were literally the lyrics were directly out of his journal and about his feelings towards others and experiences. He has a really hard time. I don't know if it's diagnosed of anything, but I know he's been mentioned several times that he has a very hard time feeling together and write with people, and so that's one of the reasons that the band broke up, because he felt very isolated, and he did it to himself. He's even said it. I mean, but he lost. I think he said at one point, if I find the quote, I can remember it, but it's something like he lost perspective on how it felt to be around other people, because he spent so much time kind of locked up in his own head, thinking on his own thoughts and not really thinking about other people and collaborating very much with other people. And so he kind of drove a wedge between the band members and him. And since then they've actually gotten back together, early last year in 2017, and did a handful of shows all over, San Francisco, New York. There's a couple in LA. They did a big music festival in Seattle earlier this year, halfway through this year in June, where they played the very first song the band ever wrote with Schwarzenbach Blake on vocals. It's also the opening song on Bivouac. And it was the first time they ever played it in 22 years. Pretty cool. And then they did a couple shows in Portland, Austin, Coney Island, and Asbury Park. Have thrown on the idea of recording new songs, haven't really done it at all. Speaking of songs and covers, there's a really cool Jawbreaker tribute called Bad Scene, Everyone's Fault, which is actually a name of a song, which is a really good song, where various bands, everyone from Fall Out Boy, well, not everyone from, but including Fall Out Boy, Bayside, Face to Face, and Sparta, did covers of various Jawbreaker songs. Matter of fact, Jim from At the Drive-In / Sparta is quoted of saying that he takes his singing style and thought process or writing process much like Blake did, and he sees him as one of his biggest influences for not only playing guitar and At the Drive-In, but a way he wrote and sang his songs in the band Sparta, which is his side project after the weird hiatus split thing that At the Drive-In went through. Sorry about that. So that's a pretty cool one too. If you check that out, it's got a lot of really cool bands and covers on there. Things you can really do for yourself with all of Jawbreaker's stuff is if you go back and you listen to, I know it's on iTunes because it's what I used earlier this week while I was listening nonstop to them to rekindle and re-listen to a lot of stuff. You can really hear the growth and the change they went through from Unfun all the way to Dear You. And also it's really fun on Etc. I just wish they would have put a lot of the songs in order, because you could have heard the progression in those too. But some of the songs weren't mixed at the same time as they originally recorded, so it's not the same. But that's basically it for Jawbreaker. And Jawbreaker was my introduction to a lot of people will say early emo, and they were very emo, but not the type of emo everyone kind of consists of. They're very heavy into the punk rock and pop punk, as you could probably really say, and really in like they were heavy influences on bands like Jimmy Eat World and Dashboard Confessional. They were very large influences on one of my favorite bands, and how I actually learned about one of my favorite bands is Get Up Kids, because I actually saw the Get Up Kids with Jets of Brazil. No, it was with Jawbreaker. I want to say it was in 96, the summer of 96, or it might have been 95. Was it when Dear You came out? I think so. I should probably know this. This was going to be my one of my big details about it is that's how I found out who the Get Up Kids were, really. I heard them on tour. It was 96. It had to have been, because that's right when they started, right? Yeah, they were on, I don't want to say tour. I don't think they were really a tour, a big, big tour. But they played a couple shows right when Woodson had come out, I think. Woodson had just come out. Woodson's the first release by the Get Up Kids, later released in a combo pack with Red Letter Day. As a matter, I'll talk about the Get Up Kids another day. But that's when I first heard Get Up Kids, and that's when I first discovered them, and I love them a lot. So, yeah, that's it for Jawbreaker. As for what I'm listening to or reading, I know I mentioned a lot of that stuff. I finished up the Dan Brown book, Origin. I want to say letdown. It was a good book, but it wasn't nearly as good as a lot of the other Dan Brown, Robert Langdon books. This one had kind of an easy to figure out everything. I think he delved more into the philosophies and the thought processes in this book than the actual stories. And really, if you I don't, if you're going to plan on reading it, I guess don't listen to the next couple words I'm going to say, because it will ruin it for you. I figured out who the bad guy was kind of right away, just because the way they talk about him. And it's not who you think it is. He misleads you a lot with the things, but it was just kind of very easy to figure out. So it was kind of not my favorite of the Robert Langdon books, but it was good. It did not have nearly the ending and impact that the one before it had on there I talked about too. But anyways, that, and then I'm about to finish the book Ahsoka, which is a Star Wars book about Ahsoka Tano, one of the apprentice to Anakin Skywalker. Really, it's a fun book. It's cool the way they tie it into a lot of stuff. It takes place after the Clone Wars, basically in this timeline, Luke and Leia are about 5 or 6 years old. They're not really parts of the book. Leia's mentioned, and the boy is mentioned at one point. Luke is mentioned by a part when Obi-Wan comes into it. But it's a cool little jumps around to different characters other than Ahsoka, and it basically talks about what Ahsoka's been doing after Order 66 went through, and she's been on the lam for a few years, trying to stay alive and away from everybody after faking her death along with her clone companion, a clone trooper companion of hers who went beyond his. I don't know. I got to find the story for this because it sounds really cool. But he somehow didn't take part in Order 66, which was the mandate built into a chip that was built into the clone troopers that on a certain day with a certain command, the Order 66 would turn and kill all the Jedi they were working with, because Palpatine set up his plan where the clones who were part of the clone army for the Galactic Senate and everybody, they would be commanded by Jedis throughout the galaxy. So all these different places where the Clone War, during the Clone Wars, where the Galactic Republic, which then later turned on the Galactic Empire, their armies, which were consisted of the clones and the Jedi, were fighting against the Separatist forces, which Palpatine used as pawns to make this galactic war happen. And then he used the clone troopers along with all the Jedi to fight against them. And then as they were winning the war and everything was kind of like all the big battles were won and a lot of the plans were freed from the control of the Separatists, he turned on Order 66, which is what happens at the end of Revenge of the Sith, right before the fall of Anakin, right at the fall of Anakin Skywalker to become Darth Vader. Order 66 was enacted, and it basically turned all the clone troopers turned on their leaders and basically shot dead or killed many of the Jedi, thought to be all of them. We know of a few that escaped. Anakin escaped technically, but they say he died in the Clone Wars. They said he was killed by Vader. But Obi-Wan was supposed to be dead. Yoda was supposed to be killed by Palpatine, no less. And all the big ones you were killed. Mace Windu was killed by Anakin and thrown out of the window after being sort of electrocuted. But so that was a big thing. So she'd been on the run and the hiding from the Empire. And this is about her, a little bit of her life and kind of her regaining her, not her command, but basically her life because of what she's kind of put the Jedi ways behind her. And she's, she feels guilty for surviving essentially. And this is basically her, coming back to herself and getting a new meaning in life and realizing just because the Jedi have been hunted down and killed doesn't mean that since she's alive, she shouldn't use what she's learned and how and who she is to help those people being oppressed by the Galactic Empire. And there's a Bail Organa's in it, who is Leia's adoptive father. Wedge Antilles' older brother is in it a little bit. But it's a fun little read. The Star Wars books are really fun. If I've never really talked to him on here before, I know I've talked about the ones I've read a couple times. But the audiobooks are a real fun treat because they have sound effects and stuff. But the books are real fun too because they mention a lot of recurring stuff in it and things like that. So it's pretty cool. But yeah, that's it for what I've been reading. And that's it for this week's episode of The Awesome with Cody. Again, we were talking about Jawbreaker. And you should check them out. They're on all digital platforms. You can listen to them on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, I believe, has them as well. So you can listen to them on there. Or just pull them on YouTube and watch a bunch of the songs on there because I'm sure someone has them in playlists on there. They only released like one or two videos. Fireman was like one of them. But yeah, you can still find them everywhere. That's it for this week's episode. Of The Awesome Cody. As usual, let's be awesome.